All right, good morning, everybody. It is 8:05, Thursday, September 24th, and we're doing a review session for Chem 30A. All right, so Kimberly, Claire, you guys are the ones that are here. You get to dictate kind of what we review or what we do, and whatever problems you want to look at. If you have specific problems in mind, that was sort of what I had intended or had mentioned in terms of last Tuesday, was to come in with some ideas. So what do you guys want to work on this morning? Oh, and Daisy's here too. Good morning, Daisy. No specific ideas or nothing coming through yet. Well, you guys are looking through all your paperwork and trying to figure out what it is you want to do yet. That could be too. Well, maybe what we ought to do then, if that's the case, let's go and let's take a look at Canvas. And we'll go to the modules. And down in module 2, I know where it is. It's at the end. There's a review in like one of the last modules is where she put it. I know I'm zooming through things. I apologize. Supplemental practice problems, study guide, exam 1 study guide. Okay. What to know, what we need to do. So know how to use the scientific notation and significant figures, know why we use each and be able to correctly perform calculations using them. What is the formula for density? Rearranging this formula to solve for mass and also for volume. And she gives an example there. The density of milk is 1.04. How many grams of milk are in 50 milliliters of milk? Compare 1 milligram to 1 gram to 1 kilogram, be able to convert from metric unit to another. How many milligrams are in 2 kilograms? Explain the terms physical and chemical property and physical versus chemical change. So if anything in here, as I'm reading through these, if anything in here jumps out at you that you want me to go over in detail, go ahead and either throw it in the chat or unmute your mic real quick. There's only 3 of us here. So, so feel free to unmute your mic as you want to. Define mixtures versus pure substances, elements versus compounds, and homogeneous versus heterogeneous. What is the formula for percent? Rearrange this formula to solve for the part and also for the total. Example, 15% of the class wears glasses, 5 students wear glasses. How many students are there in the class? Percents tend to be one of the more tricky things to utilize, or at least to figure out how to utilize in a dimensional analysis problem. Maybe we could do one of those as well and look at percents. Compare the terms, describe the structure of the atom, including the location and charge of protons, neutrons, and electrons. Compare the terms of atom, ion, and isotope, explaining what varies in each. Compare and contrast terms of atomic number, atomic weight, mass number. Be able to determine the number of protons, neutrons, and electrons for a given isotope. Describe the periodic table, including as many organizational patterns and trends as you can. Significance of period numbers, group numbers, position in the table, atomic size, etc. Be able to determine if an atom will gain electrons or lose electrons, and how many it will gain or lose when it forms an ion. That's a good topic to look at as well. Understand electron configuration, where electrons reside in an atom, and how many at each position. Example, given the electron configurations for sodium, aluminum, neon, see lab 26 for examples. Okay, did anything in there strike a chord on where you want me to start? I know I had sort of thrown out percents as being something that's more complicated. And I would see, besides describing terms in here, I would see percents as being the more difficult thing to handle sometimes. Nobody has any sort of preference in terms of where they want me to go. Is this thing even on? Can you guys even hear me? Maybe you can give me a thumbs up. Let me know that people are alive. Percents. Okay, Kimberly. That works. All right, let's see what I can do with percents. One of the classic examples that I like to bring from percents is alcohol. Whenever you look at a wine bottle or a beer bottle or any of those things, that they always list the percent alcohol that is in. Okay, no worry, Daisy. No worries. They always list the percent alcohol that's in the wine. So let's say that we have a sample problem. We're going to deal with percents. So this is exam one review. And we're going to be looking at percents real quick. And the idea behind percent, what a percent is, how do we use percent? This is, percent is described as the part divided by the whole, and then times 100. So that's the percent formula. That's how we get to percent. When we look at percent, let's say that we have a particular problem. What do we do with this problem? If a wine has or is listed as Finley, calm down. If a wine is listed as 12.5% alcohol, how much alcohol would be consumed if you drank, let's see, 750 milliliters, let's do 250 milliliters of wine. Okay, so in the same way that we've been doing, dimensional analysis problems, I always like you to define the given and the conversion factors and the desired. So here we've got our given is 250 milliliters of wine. Let's do the whole wine part because that's what we've got. And that's going to be our given. Our desired is how much alcohol? So that is our desired. And then everything else we assume is some type of conversion factor. And so we'll take the 12.5% alcohol as being a conversion factor or inequality. And so we need to figure out how to write this as an equality. Whenever you're given a percent, the way to deal with a percent is to take the number 12.5 and to write it over 100. And this 12.5 is going to, we're going to apply units to these. And percents are generally unitless. Now, when we say percent, it's usually listed, I should have put in here alcohol by volume. And when we say by volume, we mean just units of volume, and it can be any units of volume. All it needs to do is it needs to be 12.5 parts out of 100 whole. And that's the way that we're going to use it. And in order to... Oh, Claire, I'm using notability. Notability is my favorite app that is on the iPad. And I've tried a whole list of apps to do notes with. And Notability is my favorite just for ease of use. It has great ability to be able to draw and color code, and you can actually even convert the text to type, and you can search it so that you can search handwritten text through Notability, which is pretty darn good too. So it's got a lot of great features in it. All right, unit wise, this can be 12.5 milliliters of alcohol over 100 milliliters of wine, or we can write it 12.5 gallons of alcohol over 100 gallons of wine. All that has to happen is that these units that are here, milliliters to milliliters, or in this case, gallons to gallons, the units must be the same, top and bottom, but they may be any units of volume. So any units of volume are acceptable. They just must be the same. And that's the only restriction in terms of how we do that. And what we always do is we take the number, we take the part and write it over 100 in terms of the whole. So if I wanted to write this out, Kimberly, that's a very small, grouchy golden doodle with a bad attitude who likes to protect the house too much. He's, I can get him, I'll show him later. I'll grab him and bring him into the picture. I actually have two. I've got two small, about 13-pound golden doodles, and they're miniature miniature poodles crossed with miniature goldens. And Finley, our male dog, who's about 3.5, he's the one with the bad attitude who needs to bark at everything. Okay, so when I write this as an equality, and I'm looking at our units and what units we were given. We were given milliliters. So I'm going to use milliliters in terms of my problem. And the way that I'm going to write out my equality is I'm going to write it out 12.5 milliliters of alcohol equals 100 milliliters of wine. And then we'll do our roadmap real quick. So our roadmap is going to show us going from milliliters of wine to milliliters of alcohol. And it's just that one step for this problem. It's just a simple problem in that regard. And our milliliters of alcohol are here, taken to milliliters of wine. So we only need the one conversion factor. So we start with 250 with a decimal, milliliters of wine. We multiply by the conversion factor. Remember that the unit that is here, this unit always comes down into the denominator. So milliliters of wine will go in the denominator. Our desired milliliters of alcohol. And we will cancel out our units. We'll have milliliters of alcohol. And we go back and we look at our equality and we get our numbers. It is 12.5 over 100. And so we'll just take 250 divided by 100 and multiplied by 12.5. 31.25 milliliters alcohol. Okay, and then we always go back, and our last part is to look at sig figs and do sig figs real quick. So 3 sig figs because of the decimal point in the milliliters of wine. In the conversion factor in percents, the sig figs are always carried in the numerator. So this is 3 sig figs in the numerator. We don't worry about the denominator because that 100 was baked into the percent. So the number that is the percentage, the 12.5, is what carries the sig figs. So that's 3 sig figs. So we have to round to 3 sig figs in the 31.25. The value to the right of where we're rounding is a 5. So we round up. So this becomes 31.3. And that's our answer. All right. So there's a problem with percents. And the thing about percents is that we always write it over 100. And so we could look at a number of different percents. There's a number of different types of percent. So types of percent. We can have percent by volume, in which case this would be whatever number we get, milliliters over 100 milliliters of the part and the whole, or it could be X milliliters, not milliliters, let's do liters of the part over 100 liters of the whole. As we said, the units just need to match. We can have percent by mass. In percent by mass, we're looking at units of mass. So these would be X grams of the part over 100 grams of the whole. Or we could use other units, other mass units. So these could be English units as well as SI units. So we could have X pounds of my part over 100 pounds of my whole. The units just need to match. And those are the two most common. We can have percents that are volume to mass or other sorts of percentages, but these are the main two, percent by volume and percent by mass. And your percent by mass are for things that are solids, your percent by volume are things that are liquids. So that's a little review on percents. Okay, what else would you like to try to do? Anything special you guys want me to look at? Let's go back to our list real quick. Two or three what, Kimberly? Oh, on the list. Got it. Okay. Let's go back and look at that list. Two or three. What is the formula for density? Rearranging that formula and then compare 1 milligram to 1 gram. Okay. Density problems. I don't think of density problems as being any different than any other unit conversion. So when we look at density, when we look at density problems, density equals mass divided by volume. And what most people do, I fear, is they look at density as a formula where they reduce it down and they just look at this as a formula and they say that density equals mass divided by volume, or they'll say equals grams over milliliters. So that's frequently, we just reduce the density to grams over milliliters. However, I don't like to think of it as a formula like that, because when you think of it as a formula mathematically, you have to rearrange it. We could solve for the density, we could solve for the mass, we could solve for the volume. But I like to think of them more as a dimensional analysis problem, more than I think of them as a mathematical formula that needs to be solved. If you take the math component out of it and the need to solve a formula, then it falls into our dimensional analysis framework, and we can use all the tools that are in our tool belt to solve a dimensional analysis problem, and it just includes density. So let's look at it as a dimensional analysis problem rather than a mathematical problem where we need to solve the formula. For instance, let's say that we have a problem that says, the density of aluminum is 2.3 grams per milliliter. How many pounds of aluminum, or how many pounds would a block of aluminum weigh if the volume of the block is, let's do it in terms of milliliters, let's do 562 milliliters. Okay, so same concept. We're going to take and we're going to define our desired. How many pounds? So we're looking for pounds. And we are given the volume of the block in terms of milliliters. So it's 562 milliliters. So we're going from, in our roadmap, we're going from milliliters to pounds, and we're given a conversion factor or an equality that is density that is grams per milliliter. And when we see that 7.23 grams per milliliter, we need to think of that as an equality. And so I would write that this way. I would say 7.23 grams equals 1 milliliter. And that's what we mean with the units with the dashed line, where it's grams per milliliter. And when we say grams per, that means grams equals. That per means equals. So language-wise, per also means equals, which allows us to be able to write it as an equality so that we can get it out of the numerator and denominator so that we can better use it. Okay. Roadmap wise, we're going from milliliters to pounds. It's important to realize that in milliliters, you're in a volume and that this is an SI volume and that pounds is a mass and that this is an English mass. And so at some point from my volume, I am going to have to convert from a volume side to a mass side, and I'm going to need a volume to mass conversion factor. And that's what density is. Density is that volume to mass conversion factor. And so density being in milliliters allows me to convert milliliters into grams. So that's what this first step is going to be. This first step is going to be milliliters into grams. And I've successfully converted. That's my density conversion factor that I'm going to use. That's my 7.23 grams equals 1 milliliter. That's going to represent that. And now I got to get from grams to pounds. They didn't give me that conversion factor within the problem, but that is one of the three keys. So you guys have heard me talk about the three keys. That's one of the three keys. We'll remind you guys of those keys again. That's a conversion factor that allows me to get from grams to pounds. So 1 pound equals 453.6 grams. And that is one of the three keys. So you've heard me use that before. And now we've successfully completed the roadmap. Now we could finish out this problem. 562 milliliters was my starting value. And we could write in aluminum. We're going to multiply that by a conversion factor that's going to take me from milliliters in the denominator to my first stop, grams in the numerator. And then I need to look at that conversion factor and make sure that I get the numbers correct. 7.23 grams for 1 milliliter. And then I'm going to convert the grams. Now remember, we took milliliters and we started it in the denominator. We've canceled that. We're taking grams and we're moving it into the denominator and our next desired pounds into the numerator. And we make sure that the values, one goes with pounds, 453.6 goes with grams. We've now canceled grams and I only have the one unit left, pounds. So this problem is going to be 562 times 7.23 divided by 453.6. That's 8.957, 804. I'm going to stop it there because we don't need any more than that to determine the sig figs. And then we go back in and we look at sig figs. 3 for the 562, 3 for my density, 4 for my conversion factor from pounds to grams. So 3 is my smallest. Looks like I'll be rounding up because of that 7. So that's going to equal 8.96 pounds of aluminum. And that would be the answer that I would report. Okay. So while we can use density as a formula to interconvert and rearrange to solve for a specific thing, I like to just think of it as another conversion factor, another equality that allows me to throw it into a dimensional analysis problem. And I don't think of them as being any more difficult or any different than any other problem. The only thing that comes into play sometimes is a little bit different type of problem with density. If a solution has a volume of 9.62 milliliters and a mass of 10.37 grams, what is the density? What is the density of the solution? Here you need to actually think about the formula for density. So when we look at density in this case, if you were taking the test in person, would it still be multiple choice? Hang on, Kimberly, I'll come back and I'll answer that question. Here, density equals mass divided by volume in the proper units. So we need to just sort of recall what that formula is. And in this case, what I would do is I would take my mass of 10.37 grams and divide it by my volume of 9.62 milliliters, and we get grams per milliliter. So in this case, we don't have a dimensional analysis type problem. We simply have a mathematical formula where we're doing a straight division. 10.37 divided by 9.62. And we get 1.077962. And I think that's enough in order. And grams per milliliter. Sig figs wise, it would be 4 and 3. So we round to the smallest. because this is division. If it were multiplication, if it were addition and subtraction, we would do it differently. This would be 1.08 grams per milliliter. Now, I tend to write that as a diagonal line, but it could certainly be written this way. We could write it 1.08 grams over milliliters. And the interpretation there is that it is 1.08 grams over 1 milliliter. So these are all different ways of writing the answer. That we could write that answer in a number of different ways. Okay. So that's another density problem there where you're actually calculating the density as opposed to using the density. Kimberly, if we were taking the test in person, would it still be multiple choice? My guess is yes. As I'm uncertain as to what Krista's preferences are for exams, although I believe that Krista does have multiple types of problems, that she will do multiple choice problems, but also probably some problems where you're actually just doing the calculation. If it were my test and you were in my class, there would be no multiple choice because I have never written a multiple choice problem in my life. I avoid them as much as I possibly can. And and that's because that's my testing style. I mean, that's my presentation style as well, is that when I'm showing you problem types, I never do a multiple choice type problem. I always leave it open-ended. And that's because I'm looking to see your work. I'm looking to see your thought process. And I can't see that in a multiple choice test. But Canvas also, because we're doing it within Canvas, that's really our limitation, is to be able to do multiple choice within Canvas. There are other problem types that we can do, but they're much harder to program within Canvas. So thank you for that question. Okay. This recording, Daisy, will be available later. Yes, as soon as we're done with class, I will turn around and I will post it online as quickly as I can, usually during the office hours, if I have a few minutes there. And so I would assume that they'll be up, let's realistically say that they'll be up by 11 o'clock once my office hours are over, if not before then, okay? Yes, Kimberly, let's do an addition with sig figs. Let's do a problem like that. Okay, so sig figs with addition and subtraction. Okay, here, when we do sig figs for these types of problems, usually they're combined with multiplication and division in the same problem. But let's start off first. We'll start off slow. We'll look at just addition and subtraction and see what we need to do there. Let's say that what we're doing is we are calculating the perimeter of something. And we want to go through and we want to measure the perimeter of an object. And our object is a little irregular. And so we have a number of different measurements that we're going to add up in order to figure out what that perimeter is. And as we go through and we use the ruler, some of these sides are long and some of these sides are smaller. So this is maybe 1.62 centimeters, 1.70 centimeters. We have a longer length here that is maybe 5.23 centimeters. And then this one is looking like it's about 6, that's smaller. Let's say that we switch rulers for some reason, or we read a reading incorrectly, and so we only get it at 4 centimeters. This one, let's make it longer, 10.2 centimeters. This one looks like it's less than 1, 0.962. We're back close to 1 point. Oh, we missed one. I got to get in there. I made this too complicated, but that's okay. We'll just have a lot of numbers we need to add up. 1.52, 1.50, and then 1.53, and the last one here, that I got to sneak in on this one, 1.59. Okay, all in centimeters, and we're adding all these up. So we're adding up 1.62, 1.70, 5.23, 4.0, 10.2, 0.962, 1.59, 1.53, 1.50, 1.52, and that's it. Okay, so I've got all my measurements in there, and I'm going to add these all up, and these are all in centimeters. So we're figuring out what the perimeter is. Okay, let's just quickly look at how many sig figs are in each one of these values. There are three sig figs. There are three, two, three, 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 and three. So the smallest number is two. But let's look at it by place value. Those are the hundredths, 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 tenths, tenths, thousandths, tenths, hundredths, 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 and hundredths. Okay, when I add all these together, we do it by place value, by which of these values go up and down the most. So when I'm looking at which values go up and down the most, what I'm seeing is that this is plus or minus 0.01. All of these, plus or minus 0.01, plus or minus 0.01. This one is plus or minus 0.1, as is this one. This one is really tiny, plus or minus 0.001. And then all of the rest of these are the same. So when I look at which one of these numbers goes up and down the most, the number that I find goes up and down the most are these two right here. It's this one and this one. And notice that they have the same uncertainty in the same place value, even though they have different numbers of sig figs. When we do addition, we round by place value. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to drop a line that is going to come down here by place value. And because my numbers aren't all perfectly aligned, I need to wiggle that line around a little bit. But now I'll add them all up, and I'll use the calculator to add them all up. 1.62 plus 1.7 plus 5.23 plus 4 plus 10.2 plus 0.962 plus 1.59 plus 1.53 plus 1.5 plus 1.52. Okay, I get an answer that is 29 decimal place, 852 centimeters. As I do that rounding, I'm going to do the rounding to this location right here, rounded to the five. I'm rounding to the tenths position. And as I round that to the tenths position, that's going to come out to 22.9 centimeters as the total length of my perimeter. And that's the correct number of sig figs. It's three sig figs. Now look at the sig figs. We had three, we had two. Two was the smallest, but I don't round to two sig figs. I round by place value. I round by whichever answer has the least precision by place value. And so whichever one goes up and down the most, which is these two here, that's the place value where I do my rounding. Okay, so that was a longer problem, but I wanted to clarify that it's important that as these numbers add together, sometimes the sig figs can go up or down beyond what was ever given in the problem. So with subtraction, the sig figs can go down. With addition, the sig figs can go up. So if it was multiplication, we would have rounded to 23. That is correct. If we were multiplying these, we would have done two sig figs and we would have rounded it to 23. That's correct, Kimberly. So that's the difference between multiplication and division versus addition and subtraction. And if they're in the same problem, let's say that we're doing a problem where we need to add some things together and we need to do some multiplication and division. So these types of problems, example with both. Let's say that I need 3.27 plus 100.6. And then I'm going to multiply this by 0.813. And I'm going to divide it by 0.962. And that these are all values that have sig figs associated with them. And so I'm looking at the numbers. And what I would do is I would do them in order of operation. So as I'm looking at that, I'm going to do what is in the parentheses first. I'm going to do the addition first. So I take that addition, 3.27, and I'm adding it to 100.6, and I add those two numbers together. And I do my rounding based on my place value. And so this is going to be 103.9. in terms of that number that is in there. So I do that part first. So the way that I actually do this, when I say I do it first, I track the sig figs. I don't actually do the rounding because I don't want to create what's called round off error. So I know now that this is 4 sig figs. Now what I do is when I go in and I do my mathematical operation, I do 103.87. I'll put that into the parentheses. I'll say that this is good to 4 sig figs. And sometimes I even underline it just to remind myself. And then I multiply by 0.813 and I divide by 0.962, each of these being 3 sig figs. And I'll do that mathematical operation in the calculator now, not doing any rounding until the end of the problem. And I do that so that I don't create what's called round-off error. So I clear this out, 103.87 times 0.813 divided by 0.962. That's 87.782027. That's as much as I need to do there. And the smallest number is 3. So I'm going to be rounding to 3 sig figs. And my final answer would be reported as 87.8. And that would be my 3 sig fig answer. Now, what I did was I figured out how many sig figs were going to be in this part of the answer. And I used the entire thing out to 5 sig figs, but knowing that it's only good to 4, and I keep track of that in my number of sig figs in each one of those problems, and I round to the smallest number once I do that. So when I have multiplication and division with addition, do the addition first, figure out how many sig figs it will be, track it, use the whole number, don't round the number, use the whole number, but keep track of how many sig figs it is, and then do your final rounding to the smallest number based on the multiplication and division rules. The bottom is cut off a bit on the screen. I'm sorry, I didn't realize that my presentation screen is a little bit different than my screen that I'm looking at. Let me see if I can zoom out. I'll leave it like that. Okay. I'll give you a second to catch up on those notes if you were taking notes or keeping track. All right. 8:49. We've got about a half an hour. maybe a little bit more. And it was questions 2 and 3 on the list. So I think we've dealt with 2. Let's go see what 3 was on that list. Three, compare 1 milligram to 1 gram, 1 kilogram, be able to convert from metric unit to another. Okay, so this is within the metric system. And within the metric system, the System International, metric conversions. So within metric conversions, it's important to remember the units. And what I had said was, bang for the buck, we have the base. And so the base unit we think of as 1. We're going to go down, smaller than 1. And we're going to go up greater than 1. And those prefixes, we start off at centi, abbreviated with a small c. This is 1 × 10⁻². We go down to milli, lowercase m, 1 × 10⁻³. And micro, which is the symbol mu, 1 × 10⁻⁶. That's generally as far as most classes will go. Base units going up, we would go to generally starting off at kilo. This is a lowercase k. This is 1 × 10³ mega, capital M, 1 × 10⁶, and giga, capital G, 1 × 10⁹ in terms of those. And we said that the most common that you'll see, if you're really trying to reduce down the amount of memorization that you're doing, it's centa, milli, and kilo. That those are your 3 most common conversions that we wind up using. So how do we go back and forth and use these then? Let's say that we have, let's say that we have 1.627 kilometers. Let's convert 1.62 kilometers into millimeters. How do we do this? There are a couple of different ways to do it. Because of the way that the conversion factors are written out, I prefer to always think about this in a roadmap sense, as going from kilometers, my given, to the base unit, meters, and then to whatever small unit that I want to go out to, millimeters. So I always stop at the base or take it back to the base before I go to a different place, just to make it easier. We could certainly find a way to go directly from kilometers to millimeters, but good morning, Felipe. But that that's not the preferred way that I like to do it. I just think that given that all of these conversions relate back to the base unit, that it's easiest to go through the base unit before going to a different unit of measure. So if I think about it that way, and I start off at 1.627 kilometers, and then I multiply by a conversion factor, and now I'm going to go from kilometers to meters. And there are several different conversion factors that I could put in this place. Using the definitions that I have written out this way, If I look at kilo, kilo is 1 × 10³. What that means is that I have, for every 1 kilometer, it is 1 × 10³ meters. That's the way that I would use the conversion factor as it's stated. I'll show you some other ways to do it too. I have now successfully canceled kilometers. Meters is going to go in my denominator, millimeters in my numerator. And this one, when I look at the milli, it's 1 × 10³. And what that means is that 1 millimeter equals 1 × 10³ meters. These are taking it back to the base units. Base unit. So in the way that we're doing these, the way that we're thinking about this is that if I have 1 millimeter, it is 1 × 10³ of the base, and the base is the meters that are here. So let's take, and we'll highlight out this guy as being my base and how I'm doing that conversion. And now I just need to be able to enter it into the calculator in the proper way. So this is the challenge here, is that this gets keyed in 1.627 times 1E, or sometimes it's an EE key, 3 times, excuse me, not times, actually divided by 1E, or your EE key. Now there's a special key that is either a negative that is in parentheses, or sometimes it's a plus minus that is in parentheses. It's not the subtraction sign, it's a reversal sign. So we need to be careful of what sign we choose. Then the 3, then the equals. So on my calculator, when I go through and do that, I clear it out, 1.627 times 1. Notice on mine, it's the EE key that is down at the bottom of the screen. So I hit the EE key, and then I will hit the 3. That stands for 1 × 10³, divided by, now I'll do 1EE. Mine doesn't have a difference between its subtraction and negative. And then I'll do 3. So mine's a little bit different than what you're using. And then hit equals, and I get my value. This is 1.627000 millimeters. And then I have to go through and figure out sig figs. So sig figs wise, this is 4 sig figs. These next ones though are definitions, because they are defining the units of measure by the SI system, by the metric system. So those two conversion factors don't affect the sig figs, they're definitions. So 4 sig figs is my smallest, and that means that I need to round to here. So there's no actual rounding that occurs, but I need to be careful that I write it in the right way. Now there's two ways to write it. This could be written 1,627,000. There's no decimal place, so the zeros are placeholders for the values. That is 4 sig figs. Or it could be written 1.627 times 10, and now we need to figure out the place. 1, we're going to move it over 1 place, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 6 hops × 10⁶ millimeters. Those would both be correct answers to 4 sig figs. Okay. I said I'd show you another way to do this. Let me show you another way. So still the same roadmap. The roadmap doesn't change. It's just the calculation and the way that we write the conversion factors. So our roadmap is staying the same. This is a bit cluttered, so I'm going to drop it down. This is a big or. 1.627 kilometers to meters. When we have 10 to the third, 10 to the third is 1,000. So one way to write this is, rather than writing 10 to the third, I could say that 1 kilometer equals 1,000 meters. And it's an equivalent conversion factor. Now, this is the conversion factor that that is a little bit different. So when we say that milli equals 1 × 10⁻³, that means that for every 1 millimeter, that equals 1 × 10⁻³ meters, which equals 0.001 meters. So we could do it that way, and we could say that this is 1 millimeter and 0.001 meters. And now we don't have to deal with the scientific notation. So we're just taking and expressing the scientific notation that way, and we would get the same equivalent. Or another way to say this is to flip this last conversion around. And I almost apologize for giving you so many options, but I think it's important to understand the different ways to write these out. Another way to write this out is that if this is 1,000th of a meter, so 1 millimeter is 1,000th of a meter, then that means it takes 1,000 millimeters to equal 1 meter. And that's another way to write this. And so all of these would give the exact same outcome. They are all giving 1.627 × 10⁶ millimeters. 1.627 × 10⁶ millimeters. And this one, 1.627 × 10⁶ millimeters, is actually a little bit easier to see because I'm multiplying by 1,000 and multiplying by 1,000. So I take 1, multiply it by 1,000. There's a factor of 3. Here's another factor of 3. And they add up to a factor of 6. So those are all the different options, different ways. And yeah, and then you can find the way that works for your brain. That's why I like to show them a different way. So you find the way that works best for your brain and how you like to write it. And knowing that you're doing it correctly, even though you're doing it a different way than some people might choose to do it, can be helpful. Okay, so there's our metric conversions. And the key thing here, I think the key thing is to always go to the base before going to another unit of measure. It just simplifies the calculation, makes things a little bit easier on you. So instead of trying to go kilometers to millimeters, take a stop at the base unit before going to the next stop. And that will make it a lot easier for you. Okay. How about other types of problems? Are there other things that we want to do now? Should we go back to the list and see what might be on that list? See what else we can tackle? We've covered some good ground here already. So here's our list. We have sort of been covering scientific notation and significant figures. So one we've pretty much covered. We've looked at density. We have done the metric conversion. So we've done 1, 2, and 3. We haven't done any of the definitions. We haven't explained physical versus chemical defined mixtures. We haven't done 4 and 5. The formula for percent, 6, we did. We didn't get into describing structure of atoms, number 7, or comparing terms, atom, ion, and isotope. Compare and contrast terms, atomic number, atomic weight, mass number. Those are all things that we can do. 5, Daisy's going 5, please. Define mixtures versus pure substances, elements versus compounds, homogeneous versus heterogeneous. Yes, let's do that. Okay. Mixtures versus pure, elements versus compounds, homogeneous versus heterogeneous. Wait, I want to look and see. Okay. When we look at a material, when we look at a material, let's start off with a start off with salt water. Salt water is a combination of water, H2O, and an ionic compound called salt that in chemistry we would name it sodium chloride. If we take that salt water, we can take it and we can put it into an apparatus, or even we can just put it on the stove, and we can heat it up. And as we heat up that water, we can convert it into steam. So we can take and we can put a little flame under this. And as it starts to boil, what winds up happening is we can put a little receiver over this. So we can put something that is going to catch it, that looks like an alembic, and we can condense it into another container. And as we condense it into another container, what we do is we get pure water. So over here, we can separate them out. And what's left after we do this, so this is after a given time, we also have the vessel that we evaporated the water from, and we wind up getting these salt crystals that are in the bottom that are solid. So we get liquid and we get solid. The liquid is water and the solid is the sodium chloride. And so by using heat, we can separate the two out. And the fact that we can separate the two out means that this was a mixture. It's a mixture of two materials, a mixture of water and a mixture of sodium chloride. These two things, water and sodium chloride, cannot be separated by a physical process. So this is a physical separation. And mixtures can be separated by physical means. There are ways to be able to separate mixtures, to separate out one component from another, either by boiling the water or by filtering or by some other means that we can separate out mixtures. The water and the sodium chloride, now we define as pure substances. These materials are materials that cannot be separated by simple physical means. You cannot boil water and separate it into anything other than water. You cannot take sodium chloride and filter it or dissolve it or boil it or melt it or do anything to it and change it into anything other than sodium chloride. So a mixture contains two or more components. A mixture contains two or more pure substances. A pure substance cannot be separated by physical means. There are certain reactions that we can do to break down these pure substances into other pure substances, for instance, the water. If we do a process on the water called electrolysis. Electrolysis is where we pass a high electrical voltage through the water. It can break the water down into two other substances. It can break it down into hydrogen and oxygen. These are each gases. And these gases then cannot be broken down any further. This is a pure substance. That is a compound. This pure substance compound is elements in whole number ratios that do not vary. So that's what we mean by a compound. A compound is a pure substance comprised of two or more elements in fixed ratios. Okay, and this fixed ratios, I'm going to come back to because this fixed ratios idea is incredibly important. So hold on to that fixed ratios for a minute, because that's going to allow us to be able to separate what are mixtures versus compounds. It's that fixed ratio idea. So hang on to that for a second. And then these guys down here, these are pure substances as well. But these are elements. And elements cannot be broken down by any means into anything simpler. An element is the most basic fundamental unit of nature, of matter, that has the bulk properties of matter that we expect from the periodic table. So elements cannot be broken down by any means. And the idea here that sodium chloride is also a pure substance. It's also a compound in fixed ratios. And if I do electrolysis on this, that this can be broken down into sodium, which is a metal, and chlorine, which is a gas. And these are also elements. Okay, so I said that the difference between a mixture and a pure substance had to do with fixed ratios. Let me take that and highlight that. Fixed ratios. Okay. What I mean by that is, let's say that we take salt and water, and we have a container here to put water into. And I'm going to look at some mixtures. And I'm going to add to this some salt. And this is my water that is in here. And I'm going to add the salt in different ratios. So what I'm going to get is I'm going to get maybe 0.1 grams of sodium chloride to 10 milliliters of water. I can add 0.2 grams of salt to 10 milliliters of water. And then the final one, I'm going to add 0.5 grams of salt to 10 milliliters of water. This is a mixture. These are all mixtures. They are in varying ratios and can be combined in different ratios to achieve different mixtures. And so as we take and we put that salt in there into each one of these, the amount of salt can vary. So the composition of a mixture can vary. Compare that to a pure substance. Something that is a compound, H2O. Here, the ratio of hydrogen to oxygen is fixed. And it is what defines the material. There's a joke. I'm horrible with jokes. Not horrible in that I tell a lot of jokes, horrible in that I don't tell jokes because I'm horrible at telling jokes. But there's a chemistry joke that says that a man goes into a bar and he says, "Give me a glass of water." And And the guy next to him says, he doesn't say, give me a glass of water. He says, I'll have H2O. And the guy sitting next to him says, I'll have H2O too. And when the bartender gives him the drink, the second man dies. Why did he die? Well, H2O2, this is water. This is hydrogen peroxide. Hydrogen peroxide, if you drink hydrogen peroxide, it'll kill you. And that's H2O2. So he was saying I would have H2O also, but H2O2. The fixed ratios determine what the material is, and that these materials are different substances because they come in different ratios. So water is always two hydrogens to one oxygen, whereas hydrogen peroxide is two hydrogens to two oxygens, and they have a different chemical makeup. So when we look at these molecules, it is an oxygen combined with two hydrogens, and there are some lone electron pairs here. Hydrogen peroxide has a different structure. Where the ratios are different, and they always appear in these fixed ratios. So that's the difference between a mixture and a pure substance, is that in a mixture, the ratios can change and the materials may be separated by physical means. In a pure substance, the ratios are fixed of the elements and cannot change. And that's what defines them as being a pure substance, okay? And there are two types of pure substances. So within pure substances, there are two types. There are compounds and there are elements. Compounds have two or more elements. In fixed ratios. So for instance, we've said water, but we could also have things like sugar, C6, H12, O6. So they can have many different elements that are in there in varying ratios. This is actually glucose, which is a type of sugar. Elements then are single symbols. And they can be more than one. For instance, not more than one type. They have a single type, but they may have more than one of the atoms and still be an element. For instance, hydrogens come in twos. Oxygens come in twos. Sulfurs come in eight. But some of them, like sodium and iron, come in singles. So they can come in various subscripts in ratios, 2 to 2 to 8, but it will only be hydrogen, oxygen, sulfur, sodium, or iron. It'll only be the one element, but there may be more than one of the elements that are bound together that make it what we say is diatomic or octatomic in the case of sulfur. Okay, so that's the thing about pure substances. Homogeneous versus heterogeneous. Let's look at that real quick. So homogeneous means all one phase. And by single phase, what we mean is uniform composition. Okay, so when we do this, something like salt water is a good example. If I take a container of salt water and we have sodium chloride dissolved in this, so let's say that this is 0.1 grams of sodium chloride dissolved in water. and it's 10.0 milliliters of water. And I take this and I divide it up into several smaller portions. And so I take it and I pour it into these beakers. And I pour in different amounts. So they all have slightly different amounts in it. No matter how small I divide up the material, these all have the same ratio of salt to water. They are all 0.1 grams sodium chloride for 10 milliliters of water. And that's what makes it homogeneous, is that it's uniform in composition. No matter how small a sample I take, I get the exact same ratio as I sample it. And so that's a homogeneous mixture. Let's put the word in there, mixture, because homogeneous and heterogeneous refers to mixtures. Okay, how does that compare to heterogeneous? Heterogeneous is not uniform. This is either multiple phases or, and Claire, that is correct. You will not see Na subscript 2. That is correct. That sodium does not, where we were back here, sodium doesn't come as Na2. However, Claire, to your question makes me nervous. Sodium by itself as an element will always be the symbol Na. But when sodium combines with other elements, it can take on different combinations. For instance, this is sodium oxide or sodium nitride. And so you will see sodium in combination with other elements where the subscript does change, but you won't see it by itself with a subscript. Compare that to oxygen. Oxygen is O2. This is the element. Oxygen comes as 2 in the periodic table. And yet still, when I combine it with sodium, it will be this way. This is my sodium oxide. Or if I wanted to do rust, Fe2O3, this is called iron 3 oxide. Okay, so hopefully that clarifies it a little bit, Claire. That's why your question made me nervous and I needed to like fix that right away. So hopefully that was good. Okay, back to where we were. Heterogeneous. In a heterogeneous, this is not uniform in composition. So the best way to describe something that is heterogeneous is to think about a rock that you may pick up on the side of a path, and you look at the rock and it has many different colors in the rock. It has some red and some brown and some green. And so maybe we have some sort of rock here that has different colors into that rock. Or you can even think about a piece of granite is a great example in that the granite is generally white, but has all those black flecks in it. And some areas have more black flecks and some areas have less black flecks. That is an example of a heterogeneous mixture where the composition is not uniform. If I split the object up into smaller pieces, some pieces will have more of one type of material, other pieces will have more of another type of material. And not all of the material will have the same composition. That's what we mean when we think about something that is heterogeneous, is that the composition is just not uniform. And so we can take this and we can split it up and we can divide it into four pieces. And when we divide it, those ratios become different. So I get a piece that's up here that has, maybe I should exert a little more effort into making it look like my pieces. Each of these pieces now has different ratios of material in them, and the composition is not uniform. And I'm doing it with a solid, but we could also highlight this with a liquid. And so that there are liquids that are not uniform as well, that we could highlight out. Okay, so when divided, the pieces have different ratios. Another way to think of this is an orange juice container in your refrigerator that has settled, and the pulp has all settled to the bottom. And so if you were to pour that orange juice out, some glasses would have more pulp than others. And that would then be another example of a heterogeneous mixture that has multiple phases, some that is solid, some that is liquid, and you get different ratios as you try to divide it out. So that's our heterogeneous mixture. So homogeneous is a mixture, heterogeneous is a mixture. The difference between them is that homogeneous, the composition, no matter how small you divide it out, stays the same. Heterogeneous, the composition is not uniform and varies as you divide up the substance, okay? So I think that takes care of our question regarding number 5. So we defined mixtures and pure substances, elements versus compounds, and homogeneous versus heterogeneous. Okay, so now that we've gone through 5, 6 was percent, we did that. 7, describe the structure of the atom, including the location of the charge of the protons, neutrons, and electrons. I think you guys are probably good with 7. Compare the terms atom, ion, and isotope, explaining what varies in each. How do you guys feel on that? I'm also realizing that we're down on time here, that we're 9:28 and we're almost out of time. I can go a little bit longer if you guys want to go a little over. Okay, so that one seems good. Atomic number, atomic weight, mass number. Does that one sound good? Atomic weight, atomic mass number. Mass number and atomic weight. Good on that. Okay, be able to determine the number of protons, neutrons, and electrons for a given isotope. Those tend to be not too difficult either. Describe the periodic table, including as many organizational patterns and trends as you can. Significance of period numbers, group numbers, position in the table, atomic size. 11 is actually fairly significant and important. And it relates to whether or not an element can gain or lose electrons as well. That's actually fairly important.
Jason, can I tell you what I was having trouble with?
Please.
And I think you're going to touch upon it here with this, the way you're going. Writing the ionic formulas and then the ionic charges and for transition metals.
Okay, is that actually covered? I don't know if that's actually covered on this test yet, Felipe.
Oh, really? Am I getting ahead of myself?
you might be, but when I look at her list, so I have to guess because I'm not in Krista's head here, but But she's wanting us to do whether or not they gain or lose electrons and then understand electronic configuration. But she's not talking about making ionic compounds just yet. Maybe you are on target. Maybe in terms of, in terms of figuring out the ionic charges of things, let's try that. Let's look at that. And that is a logical place to go next.
Do you mind going over it? I'm at work right now and I just got a call, so we got to go. But can you maybe just touch on that a little bit, and then I'll look at it later. I know you're recording it.
I'll hit it in the video, and then the video will get posted. Absolutely.
Perfect. Can you send me like an email with that link, because I'm having trouble finding the videos?
I will send it to you. You got it, Felipe.
Oh, you're the man, Jason. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Okay, I'm gonna write another time real quick. Okay.
All right. Thanks.
Yep.
All right, goodbye.
You know what? I'm just gonna send that link out to everybody, just to make it really clear where all the things are. So we won't hit Felipe just specifically. We'll make sure that we hit everybody so that they can all find those links. Okay, let's take a periodic table. You know what? Let's get a periodic table. Let's do it this way. I'm gonna go get a periodic table. Open recent. I don't have one sitting here where I want it. Fastest way to get it is to go to a gas chem 3 periodic table, elements with names, table with names. Okay, Kimberly, we'll see you, and everything will be posted for you. File, print, and open in preview and share it. Nice. Okay. So hopefully, there we go. In looking at the periodic table, we of course have our periods, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. And when we look at those periods, those are the principal energy levels that we're looking at. But then what we'd like to be able to do is correlate this with charges and the charges on the ions. And this, in terms of charges in the ions, when we look at electronic configurations, and we haven't had a chance to talk about this in my sections yet or in this lab section, but each one of these elements gains or loses electrons because of their desire to be like the noble gases. So when we look at the noble gases, we'll color them in purple because they're the nobility of the periodic table. And being the nobility of the periodic table, these guys have sort of like everything. They have fame, they have all of the money. And of course, in the periodic table world, all of the money means electrons. And so these guys are the rich and famous of the periodic table. They have completed energy shells, filled shells. And having that filled energy shell is extremely stable energetically. And all the other elements in the periodic table would like to have a filled out shell as well. They'd like to be rich and famous, just like the noble gases on the periodic table. And so what they do is they gain or lose electrons to become like those noble gases. Everything that is in group 7A all of these guys, they just need to get one more electron and they can be like a noble gas. And so they tend to pick up an electron. They tend to add an electron. Now, electrons are negatively charged. So charge-wise, when we look at the charge that is incurred in an ion that is in this group, these groups all become minus one. Oxygen, sulfur, selenium, they need to pick up two electrons, one, two, in order to become like their closest noble gas. Two electrons are two negative charges. Everything in this row becomes a minus two. Nitrogen, these need to pick up three. So everything in this family here needs to pick up three electrons. These all become minus three. In group 4A, they tend to share electrons more than they do anything else. And so because these guys share, we're going to get to them later in the course and talk about what they do. But starting on the side over here, this side, it's easier for these elements to lose electrons than it is to gain them. And so in losing electrons, lithium, in order to be like helium, needs to lose one electron. If you lose an electron, electrons are negatively charged. So you will have one extra positive charge. These become positive charges on this side. Everything in this family here becomes a plus one. Everything in this family, a plus two. And everything in this family, a plus three. So we can look at where a main group element is in the periodic table. These are main group elements. These are the S and P block. Everything that is a main group element is very predictable in what its elemental charge is going to be and what its ionic charge is going to be. We can tell just by looking at where it is. I can ask you, what ion does sodium form? And you know it's in group 1A, it forms a plus one ion. I can ask you what a sulfide will form, and you know it's in group 6A, it's two steps away, it's going to become a two minus ion. And so just by virtue of its position, we can tell what its charge is going to be when it becomes an ion. These here that are in the transition metal area, the D block, these are more complicated. So D block. In the D block, the ions that form in the D block have multiple charge states, because their electronic configurations are such that they have d orbitals very close to s orbitals. They can lose multiple numbers of electrons. They're all cations, more complicated. They're all cations, all positively charged, but they can have varying charge states. So for instance, iron can have plus two or it can have plus three. Copper can have plus one, or it can have plus two. Chromium can have plus two or plus three. Manganese, plus two or plus three. Cobalt, plus two, plus three. And silver always tends to have the plus one, and zinc always has plus two. They don't have multiple charge states, but others have these various multiple charge states. And in the D block, we have to just memorize what the possible charge states are. And the charge state needs to be told to you in one of two ways, either by the name of the ion or by the compound which the ion is forming. So those are the breakdowns. Main group elements. These are our 1A through 7A. These all predictable by the position of the periodic table. We can tell just by its location, whether it's going to gain or lose electrons. Transition metals have multiple charge states. And you must be told either by name or formula what the charge state is. So here we have plus ones, plus twos, plus twos, plus three, plus two, and plus four. These are the three most common charge states. And I didn't hit any plus two, plus four. I should have. Plus two for tin, plus four, and lead, plus two, and plus four. So in these groupings, tin can be a plus two state, or tin can be a plus four state, and lead plus two, and lead plus four. The most common over here is iron. Iron is plus two, plus three. But there are many that fit into this category with iron. So all of the different ones that we have in here, chromium, And these just have to be memorized in terms of the groupings in which what is possible for these elements. Chromium, cobalt, manganese, Mn 2 plus, Mn 3 plus, cobalt 2 plus, cobalt 3 plus, and then over here, copper plus 1 and copper plus 2. And then mercury is an odd duck. There is a mercury which is a 2 plus 2 and a mercury which is a true 2 plus where there's only one mercury. So this guy here, this being the odd duck where it is two mercuries bound together, each mercury is a plus 1. And so the entire complex results in a 2 plus charge, but the mercury is actually plus 1 and plus 2. So there's the different mercuries that are there. And these, this is a matter of memorization. And I said that we have to tell you which one is which, and that is true. For instance, iron, Roman numeral 2, this equals Fe 2 plus. Iron, Roman numeral 3, this equals iron 3 plus, where the Roman numeral is telling me the charge state. And that's the job of the Roman numeral. It tells me how many positive charges that ion has. And that's the name that we use and the way that we do that. But the other ones, the main group ones, are very predictable. So the main group elements, I can tell just by looking at their position what their charge states are. I think that covers it because she's not actually doing ionic compounds yet. She was just doing charges in terms of being able to predict what charge an ion has. And in answer to Felipe, these guys that have multiple charge states, I cannot ask you what the charge on an iron is without telling you the name iron 2 or iron 3. If you were asked what charge states iron can have, then you would be able to answer iron plus 2 and iron plus 3. And those are the two possible charge states. But you can't tell which charge state iron will definitely become until you either make a compound with it or you tell it its name. So another example here, just in formula wise, iron makes two different compounds with oxygen. Iron makes FeO, and iron makes Fe2O3. These are the two possible combinations. Oxygen only has one charge state. Oxygen, if we look at it in the periodic table, oxygen is here in the periodic table. It is always -2. That means that when I look at these two compounds, the way that I interpret this is that there are three oxygens, each with a 2- charge state. They add up to a total number of 6 negative charges. That's because these are fixed. That means that there must be 6 positive charges. And because I have 2 irons, I take the 6 positive charges, divide it between the 2 irons, and each of these irons then is a 3+. So I am doing 6 positives divided by 2. That means that each is a 3+. And so now I know that that is the iron 3+, and the name of this compound becomes iron, Roman numeral 3, oxide. In the other compound, oxygen is 2-, and there's only one of them. So I know that there's only a total of 2 negative charges. Those 2 negative charges tell me that there must be 2 positive charges to balance the compound. And the iron here, because there is only one of them, must be a 2+. This then is the iron Roman numeral 2, oxide. And so either you must be given a compound to be able to figure out what the charge state is, or you must be given the name with the Roman numeral, where the Roman numeral tells you what the charge state on the metal is. That's the only way that you can tell with the transition metals. Okay, we are significantly over time, and you guys have been very generous with your time and sticking with me. I hope that this was a helpful session. I hope that you got some good information out of it. And I'll get this posted online. You guys can go back and review it and watch it again for everybody who wasn't here joining with us. I hope that you find it useful. And I'll send out information so that you guys can all find the link, okay? You guys take care. Have a good weekend. Remember, I've got office hours in another 10 minutes here, coming up at 10 o'clock. So if you want to jump into those office hours, anybody is welcome. All right. See you guys later. Take care. How do I end this meeting?
Did you have class this morning where you're at? Did you have class this morning, Thursday morning? Yeah, you. No.
Stop the share, stop the recording.